All right, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Daniel Estulin is in the house. He's been on Caravan to Midnight many times, going all the way back to episode 72 on June 4th, 2014. And there's episode 248 and 435 and 718 on April 5, 2017, to boot. His new book is In the Shadows, plural, of a Presidency. He's the author of The True Story of the Bilderberg Group and Tavistock Institute, Shadow Masters, an international network of governments and secret service agencies working together with drug dealers and terrorists for mutual benefit and profit. Transhumanism, the Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, and Tavistock Institute, Social Engineering of the Masses. Scary stuff, it really is. Now, his new one, In the Shadows of a Presidency, is a little bit alarming when I read the first paragraph on the back cover. And then the second graph, I went, wow, this is going to be quite interesting. It always is when we speak with Daniel. So let me read you this part just to get you going. On November 8, 2016, the seemingly impossible became real. Donald Trump, billionaire tycoon, with fundamentally xenophobic, savage, and populist speech, won the presidency and began endangering values like democracy and world peace. Now, I immediately took umbrage with that, but I'll get into that with Daniel in a minute. This volume asks, meaning this book, how did America get here? Was it a truly democratic event? And above all, what are the interests behind the election of Trump? From his privileged status as a Russian ex-spy, Daniel Estulin dives into the long process that has led Donald Trump to the presidency. In the Shadows of the Presidency offers a behind-the-scenes chronicle of the actors, governments, companies, and institutions involved in his election and the payout it will yield for insiders. Right? Now, let's go to graph two. On the global stage, Trump has become the symbol and mouthpiece of those forces that are not ready to sacrifice America for global schemes and will forego them for the sake of America First ideology. This vision represents a radical change in the balance of forces in the global arena and consequently a change of the direction in which mankind is going. This is an issue of universal concern. We are witnessing actors in a process where the world is entering a new era. It is an era marked by the struggle for national liberation of society separated by state boundaries and customs against their common enemy, the all-destroying dominance of the global ruling class against the background of looming social collapse. Wow, that's pretty heavy for one back cover. And then there's a bio on Dr. Daniel Estulin, who takes up the remaining third. So let's talk about it and just see where Daniel's coming from on this, from the unique position of a former Russian spy. He's now up in Canada somewhere. And I always like talking to him, no matter really what we talk about. So let's get into it. Once again, please welcome back to Caravan to Midnight, Daniel Estulin. Hey, Daniel, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, sir. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, these paragraphs seem to contradict each other a little bit. At least I'm thinking so.
Well, they do. You know why? Because the first paragraph was written from the point of view of the masses. And the second paragraph is written from the point of view of Daniel Estulin. And that's why they contradict. Because the first paragraph states what people see in Donald Trump. And then the second paragraph says what he is not. Before we actually get into this, you know, when we talk about, you know, Donald Trump, when I speak of Donald Trump, people, first thing they want to know is, so are you for or against? You know, so let's just get that out of the way. I cannot be for or against because I'm not American. I am you said I'm a spy. I am, but I'm an analyst of military counterintelligence, which basically means that I look at Donald Trump as a paleontologist would look at a dinosaur. I'm not saying that Donald Trump is a dinosaur. One day he will be. But the point is that I look at him, I smell him, I touch him, I taste him. I examine him under the microscope to see what he is, how he moves, what makes him tick internally and externally. And I basically explain the forces behind the persona of Donald Trump, because Trump, for all intents and purposes, is once-in-a-lifetime black swan event. And here he is. It's a very, very different book from anything out there, whether it's written by Fox or whether it's written by people at CNN or, you know, all that stuff out there, the claptrap, the lies, the demolition job that so many people done on Trump. Well, they don't explain beyond, you know, the trivialities of, you know, bedtime stories, is the internal mechanism of how this individual became president and what the or the consequences of this presidency for the future of mankind.
Let me ask you this, Daniel, and this goes to really, I don't know, we've had so many conversations, I don't know the question before or not. I've got that cough going too, but it's rained for 6 weeks. And yesterday it was in the high 60s, lower 70s. Now it's in the lower 40s. So it's like.
Well, in Canada, one day it's like -4. The next day it's like 25 Celsius. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So,
25 Celsius.
It was 25 last week. And then the next day it was like 4.
Yeah. I think what everybody should understand right now, let's just take a little moment. And now here's CTM weather. We're into the 400-year cycle. Here it is. The last time, roll back the clock to 1618.
Exactly.
And right around that time, you'll find that the River Thames froze solid.
Yes.
2 years.
Exactly.
The sunspot content is zero right now. We're into the solar minimum. If you're not expecting a really cold and severe winter, expect it because you're going to get it.
Exactly.
What can we do to fight climate change? I got an idea. Maybe the moron idiots down here in this part of the world will stop digging a 12-inch freeze line and start digging a 36-inch like everybody else does up north where it actually snows. No, we don't do that. Because that might cut into our profits when we got to come out there and
exactly
that plumbing. Anyway, I digress. Get ready for it. Look, here's the thing. If you're a former Russian intelligence guy of any note, why are you still alive?
Why shouldn't I be? That's a question. I mean, I'm not James Bond. I'm an analyst and intelligence. Well, basically we do what I did for pretty much most of my 24 years is create on a level of conceptual intelligence models that represent or can define the future about 50 years into the future. That's what we've done. I mean, 50 years is a long period of time. Kabbalists are at it for 3,000 years at a time. We're doing it in a 50-year span, which is still pretty good. But that gives us the leeway and also the heads up to foresee certain events, which most other people don't see at all. Because, again, we have a different system in how we analyze things. Okay, so I'm not your spy in the field who does, you know, looks for documents, steals stuff, drugs someone. I don't do that kind of stuff. I was never into it. I was an analyst, and still am an analyst because, again, me working with Joint Chiefs of Staff and governments in different countries, that basically parlays into my work with them.
Well, just as a guy who's operated in that world, I mean, you can't help but hear certain things as you go through your career. Let me just come out of the chute with something out of left field. What do you make of this guy, Christopher Steele, the former MI6 spy? Why is he still walking around? And why, if that's really his face, would anybody who was a former spy just ask for the Skripal treatment by exposing himself and putting his face out all over global media? Hello, I'm Christopher Steele, former MI6 spy.
It doesn't really work like that because, again, you have to understand that Trump... I'm just going to digress for a second. Trump is not a person. By that, I don't mean he's, you know, some extraterrestrial entity. Rather, Trump is a visible face of a counter project to the global financial banking liberal elite circles, which basically controlled the world economy since 1944. And when I say that, when we're talking about the Bretton Woods model, which is now basically dead on its deathbed, we're talking about the entire apparatus of Western world, from the intelligence communities to the media, banks, financial institutions, you know, business schools, be it London School of Economics, Wharton School of Business, think tanks, foundations, organizations such as the Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, the establishment of Washington, Hollywood, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Gotcha.
So on the global stage, every institution out there, because again, you have to remember that if you go back just a little bit to the 19th century, there were four economic models out there. There was the British model in order, then the German model after the war with France in 1870, the American at the end of the 19th century, and the Japanese right after the war with Russia, Tsarist Russia in 1904, 1905, which really was a continuation of the Meiji model from 1868. Then in 1944, with the creation of the Bretton Woods, you had the world was divided into two models, from 401 to two, capitalist bloc and socialist bloc. And That worked till about 1991. And in 1991, the socialist bloc literally merged with the Western bloc into this one global liberal financial banking cartel. And so you went from four in the 19th century to two in 1944 at the end of the Second World War to one with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And now you have zero. So you have zero economic models because Bretton Woods is dead. And the consequences of that, and the fact that we're looking for a new economic model, you know, brings us up, you know, up to today, and all the fight that you're seeing on the world stage is a fight between two very, very different groups of people. The ones who've lost access to power and also lost access to emission of dollars, meaning that they can no longer have their dollars and print them with a little machine. And so all these personalities, be it Christopher Steele, be it the mainstream media, be it this whole thing with the Skripals in England, be it just anything you want to touch, the Soros's, the Rockefellers, the Bilderbergers, you know, all the stuff you're seeing in the mainstream media about Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera. It's the fight between two models that cannot coexist. And whether it's before, meaning, you know, about 30 years ago, there was enough for everyone to basically sit at the supranational table above government level and divvy up the world. Now there's not enough for everyone. So now you cannot have the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Baruchs and all these other groups of people divvying up the world into little parts. Now there's only enough for one. It's like in the film The Highlander. You can only have one at the end. And that's why the fight is to the death. And Christopher Steele, on a very, very subhuman level, okay, he's just an amoeba, a microbe, a nobody. Okay, and so all these characters, again, the question is, why is he still alive? Because again, he's just a foot soldier of this ongoing conflict between two groups. Because again, the liberals, they lost in 2016. And if you want, I can actually explain to you that we, back in 2014, 2 years before the elections, and I can tell you the date. It was November 5th, 2014, but I can't remember whether it's the day off or the day after the midterm elections at the Dartmouth Conference in Dayton, Ohio. We met with the American delegation who were there at the conference, and that had nothing to do with Russiagate and none of that other nonsense. It's just the Russians were there, we were there, the Americans were there, and we sat down and we talked. And we explained to the American delegation, I explained it in my book, it's the first paragraph of the first chapter. We said to them that, you know, we think that Donald Trump is going to be the president of the United States. And this is November 5th, the day off or the day after the midterm elections. And so when the New York Times, 2 or 3 days before, certainly a week before the elections, was calling for 90% win, you know, overwhelming win for Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump, we knew in 2014 that Trump would win, or someone like Trump, because in the end, the people that lost, the liberal banking financiers, and what do I mean by them? This is Wall Street, this is the financial institutions, this is the banks, this is the deep state, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, the people who play with numbers on a computer, who don't produce anything at all and speculate, and they control 70% of the world economy. And the industrialists, people who make something you can touch, controls 30% of the economy. And so the reason that the liberal banking financiers lost is that they no longer were able to give financial benefit, return on their investment. And so they lost, and another group came in. It was just a question of finding who amongst these people who's not a liberal could actually win. And we had three candidates. We had someone like Donald Trump. It was before Donald Trump even decided to run, because he had to have had a strong business acumen. And when Trump does, he runs the country as it was his personal empire. Then we thought of Rand Paul, but then we thought it highly unlikely that someone like Rand Paul, who had no business acumen, could actually run the country. And then, because Trump is right conservative, and so we had a left conservative, that's Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders would have won the elections had, you know, we not had the shenanigans with the Democratic Party. And so you had the left and the right conservatives. Sanders lost and Trump won. But again, we knew about this in 2014. So again, what I'm getting at, to go back to your original question about Steele, is he's just a non-entity nincompoop. That's what he is, a foot soldier who is doing what needs to be done, because again, the war is for survival. Because one of the things about this whole impeachment thing right now, the liberal banking financier Wall Street deep state cartel, and their face was Hillary Clinton. She was just a face. She was nothing else other than that. They understand that they're down, you know, in baseball parlance, now that you're in the baseball playoffs, they're down to their final out, or even maybe to their final strike. Because the point is that if they don't destroy Trump and win the midterms in the Senate and Congress and impeach Trump, and I think Trump is going to win and win big time, then Trump goes on to win in 2020, and Trump dismantles the entire liberal banking financier order. And that's going to be their end. And because the war is to the death, it's not a question of them getting off the stage. Because when you're talking about government, you're always talking about control and power. And what these people are doing, they're fighting for their lives. And you're seeing it in the United States and everywhere else in the world, being in England, being in Italy, being in France, and in Russia, in China, in the United States, and Latin America. Every nook and corner of the planet, unless you're like in Fiji somewhere out there, okay, there's a conflict going on for survival, whether it's South Africa, you know, anywhere you touch or look on the planet, we're at war. And the United States, we're on the verge, if not already, into the second civil war. And that's what, again, going back to your original question about, you know, the Christopher Steele character, he is one of tens of thousands of throwaway pieces that these liberal banking financiers are throwing at Trump, at doing their best to try to get rid of him, because again, they understand if Trump wins midterm, it's over for them.
I'm thinking it needs to be over.
You know, the thing is that if you kind of go back a little bit in time, you know, beginning in 1981, if you look at the economy, the growth of global economy in one way or another was driven by a redistribution of U.S. dollars printed by the Federal Reserve and then passed through the Federal Reserve System. And that process is controlled by the International Monetary Fund, World Trade Organization, and other global Bretton Woods institutions. And for all this talk of people saying that Bretton Woods was, you know, was abolished back in 1971 by Richard Nixon, it's all nonsense. International Monetary Fund, World Bank, World Trade Organization, these are all Bretton Woods created institutions. So the system is alive, albeit wearing a different mask. You know, and on the whole, everybody understood that money printing required assets to back surplus money. And so in the 1980s, the role of assets was played by various newly emerging derivatives. And then in the 1990s and the beginning of 2000, those were the assets that appeared as a result of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Because again, if you kind of go back to 1991, when the West thought they had won this global war, capitalism won, rah, rah, rah. That's not really the case, because one of the things about capitalism, it needs perpetual growth. And you cannot have perpetual growth on a planet Earth, okay? Because it's a closed system. And so there's two ways you can grow. You could steal, as the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, you know, the Americans did at the point of a gun, from others. But then when you run out of money, you can no longer steal. You have to think of other ways of doing it. And so the West was, you know, they got a new lease of life in 1991, because again, you have to remember that, and I explain this in the book again, because we have the information, because I worked for 24 years in the intelligence. The West was very concerned in the 1970s that they were losing the economic war and the social war against the socialist states. Okay? And whether it's the Soviet Union was going to do everything in their power not to go to war, because again, you have to remember that a lot of these people, the veterans in the Politburo, they went through Second World War. They know what war was. And because they thought, you know, that it was inevitable that they would win, they were going to do anything in their power to avoid war. Whether it's in the West, they didn't think that they could win unless they went to war. And so because of these incongruencies, what basically had happened was the West, in 1983 and 1984, Margaret Thatcher wrote a memo which basically said, oh, we destroy the Soviet Union. She actually wrote it to Ronald Reagan. Or we destroy the Soviet Union, or it's over for us. And so in 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, and it didn't fall apart because the system was worse, because in 1990, the Soviet Union was growing at a rate of 9.8% per year. Okay, why and who and what, it doesn't really matter here. We're not going to go into it. But the point is, is that because the Soviet bloc fell apart, the West got a new lease of life, non-life, which means that they were able to extend their life cycle for another 30 years. And basically, the United States had two approaches at the time, okay, if we're talking about as a result of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The first approach basically implied using assets taken from the USSR to cover debts accumulated in the 1980s and then start from scratch. That was the approach of George W. Bush Sr. administration. There was yet an alternative approach to embezzle everything and make good use of these assets. And that was done by the Clinton administration, what became known in the 1990s as the rape of Russia period of early to mid 1990s, 1996, 1997. Okay. And for that reason, people who emerged in Russia as affiliated units of the Clinton team basically means the entire financial economic structure of today's Russia is considered ideological thieves. And, you know, things were rolling along smoothly, but beginning in the year 2000, it became clear that there were no assets left, that the United States government decided to print money backed by completely fictitious assets, which, you know, are called subprime mortgages. And so by 2008, the entire system imploded. And the fact, you know, the 2008 crisis was a twin of the pre-war Great Depression that began with the United States stock market collapse in October 1929. You know, in the spring of 1930, saw a deflation shock. The crisis itself commenced in 1930. And basically, what had happened was, unlike the 1930 crisis, it's important for what we're talking about now, the American monetary authorities, mainly the Federal Reserve, for the first time openly started an issue of money not supported by any assets at all. Now, if you look at it today, if you take it to today, Barack Obama, between 2008 and 2014, printed $2.5 trillion. You know, just money came out of nowhere. I wish I had this little machine that print money at the same time. But the thing is, and if you ask, you know, Western economists, they won't explain it to you. Or they don't know, or they make sure they don't explain it to you. The thing is that there was no inflation. And the reason there was no inflation is that the credit multiplier dropped by a factor of 4 between 2008, when it stood at about 17, and 2014, when it dropped to 4. So the multiplier went down 4, and the money supply went up 4. So basically, it canceled each other out. But then in 2014, if you remember, Obama stopped the printing presses. The question is why, and people don't understand. The reason is because the fall of the credit multiplier to less than 4 kickstarts a process called non-payment crisis. And this is what happened in the Soviet Russia in 1998, when the credit multiplier went to 1.2 and the system collapsed, basically. It was dismantled. And so if you really think about this, Donald Trump is the continuation of Barack Obama's second term economic policy. Because again, if you look at it, in 2000, and do you remember the whole story with Dominique Strauss-Kahn? You know, the director general, director of International Monetary Fund,
was caught
in a New York hotel with a very questionable lady with questionable credentials. We'll just leave it at that. Okay. And then he was arrested, and can't remember whether he was in prison or temporarily in prison. But basically what people, and I explained it in my book, the story behind it, it had nothing to do, it was a setup by the Obama administration. What had happened was the elite circles, Western elite circles, understood something that most people don't understand. The fact is that unless you have growth, the system collapses. And so capitalism celebrated their victory for a period of 10 years between 1991 and 2000. Then in 2000, we had the dot-com bubble. Then in 2008, we had the Lehman Brothers. And in 2011, what the elite circles, Western elite circles, have agreed on with American liberal banking financiers is to pass the control of America's emission center, which is the Federal Reserve, and put it under the control of Bank of International Settlement, which is Bank Central Bank of Central Banks. Because the world elitists control all the emission centers except for the Federal Reserve. And Obama imprisoning or catching Dominique Strauss-Kahn made known that he was not going to allow them to control America's emission center. And then in 2012, Obama eliminated from his economic council for the first time since 1981 Reaganomics all of the members of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan. And then in 2014, he stopped quantitative easing. And in 2016, we have a Brexit and Donald Trump. So again, Donald Trump is the continuation of Barack Obama's second term economic policy. I think that might explain to people some of these issues, which we don't really, you know, look at very, very often. But the point is that, again, people look at Donald Trump as something, this, you know, this crazy kooky character who does unsavory things in Russian hotel rooms, you know, with unsavory creatures. But the point is that he is not a person, but a project of one part of the alternative global elite circles.
Wow. You know, let me ask you this. The Soviet Union gaining over 9% GDP year after year there for a while. Wasn't there, what were they selling besides weapons and caviar?
I mean, if you kind of look at Russia's technology, remember that, you know, Russia was had 19.4 or 19.6, I can't remember, of global financial markets. The United States had 20.6, if I'm not mistaken. But today's America has less of a global market than the Soviet Union did back in 1989 or 1990. I mean, if you look at Russian technology, you know, the internet was, you know, actually originated in Russia with this project called OGAS, O-G-A-S. That was in 1962, okay? And the guy who actually put it together was the guy who was the head of Russian cybernetics unit. Whether you're talking about Sputnik, we're talking about, you know, space technologies, you know, engineering, all that kind of stuff. Was Russia was exporting all that stuff to, you know, to Africa, to Asia, to, you know, to the Middle East, to South America. Don't forget that Russian, the territory itself is so large that, you know, the amount of grain that the country could export anywhere in the world surpassed anything out there. You know what I mean? So Russia had, again, the information you get in the West is that, you know, Russians were starving to death sucking on their finger, which is basically not true. It's propaganda. It's not true.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. Okay, so, well, look. Pretty obvious to me after reading the entire back of a credit card statement back in the 80s, that in a capitalistic system, you cannot continually expand markets. You're eventually going to run out of markets. So what do? In looking at these credit card statements, I realized that if you have M1 and M2, M1 being the cash and the savings accounts and the checking accounts and stuff like that, liquid money. If these bills, if everybody decided to get a Visa card, because it's everywhere you want to be and all that, that was the big advertising logo in those days. Those bills came due on, say, the 7th of next month or whatever. There's not enough cash in the system to pay it all. So I thought, inflation, deflation, depression, stagnation. Okay. It seems to me that you inflate this capitalist bubble. And when it gets to the bursting point, if you don't want it to burst, you have to do one of two things, either print more cash and inflate or start throwing people out of the system. Bankruptcies, foreclosures, seizures, receiverships, all that stuff. And I think what you just said kind of goes to that point, unless ultimately, I've said this before too, the actual human beings become the currency. You know what I mean? Or not?
I know very much what you mean. I mean, I wrote a book called Trans-Evolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction. I mean, they're harvesting people as we speak. One of the reasons about this whole artificial intelligence is, you know, man-machine projects, etc., is you get people to live for a very long time. And this is one of the ways you know they get to at harvesting people. What you said about the entire economic situation is absolutely true. I mean, if you look at the world economy today, it's on the brink of collapse. I mean, the size of a problem is of such magnitude that it simply cannot be resolved by, you know, government intervention. The Western financial system is facing a collapse of $4 quadrillion. That's 4 and 15 zeros, okay? Derivative bubbles along with credit default swaps, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, global debt is, I think, about $240 or $250 trillion. It blew by 200 and, you know, when I was writing the book, it was 217. That was like a year and a half ago. Global debt is about 325% of the world's gross domestic product. $10 trillion of global debt, that's bonds, securities, derivatives, et cetera, are negotiated and traded at negative interest rates. America's debt is $21 trillion. European banks are leveraged at 28 to 1. You have top 100 banks in Italy that are bankrupt. Top 100 banks. In Europe, five countries have debts of over $1 trillion. England, Italy, Germany, France, and Spain. There's no way to pay any of this off. In Germany, Germany's biggest bank, Deutsche Bank, its gross derivatives exposure is $42 trillion.
Is that all?
JP Morgan and Deutsche Bank account for 20% of total global derivatives exposure. Now, whether you're looking at China, whether you're looking at Japan, its debt has ballooned to about 250%. And, you know, with all this talk of America's economy doing great, you have over 100 million Americans unemployed between the ages of, I can't remember, 16 or 18 and 65. You have 50 million Americans who survive thanks to food stamps. The CIA Misery Index, which is a very important index, nobody talks about it, and it's calculated based on real inflation and real unemployment, is at 32.89 points. As a comparison, the index during the darkest days of the Great Depression was 27. The Federal Reserve has $56 billion in cash and $21 trillion in debt, and it's leveraged at 77 to 1. So basically, the bankers and the financiers, they realized that they could only save their transnational empires, all of them, and not separately, if they put their candidate in the White House. And so the new president, in that case, obviously, we're talking about Hillary Clinton, would then change the Federal Reserve policy by kickstarting the printing presses, again, something that Obama stopped in 2014, that would supply enough dollars to support, you know, the banking sector. And the Fed would hardly speak out against the administration, fearing a case similar to the Dominique Strauss scandal. Now, with Clinton, the system of quantitative easing, basically printing unlimited amounts of cash, would have continued for another 6 to 8 months. So if she had become president in January 2017, we're looking at, you know, end of August 2017. And so during that time, the oil prices and markets, they would have risen on the strength of emissions, and eventually in 8 months, this money would have returned to the American markets anyway. Okay, that's causing this huge mega, you know, galactic inflation, which have resulted in the explosion of all the bubbles of the financial markets, from the bonds, derivatives, securities, real estate. And the end result, again, the collapse. That doesn't change with Clinton or Trump, because again, we're at the gates of this worldwide economic default and dismantling of the capitalist system. The only difference is Clinton would have pushed us into world war. And that would have meant 3 or 4 billion people dead. Now, wars are always good because you can write off debts and responsibilities. Is 3-4 million a lot? That's a lot of people. But if you remember Madeleine Albright, you know, she said, yeah, we killed 500,000 Iraqi children as a result of sanctions and blockade, et cetera, et cetera. Was it worth it? According to her, yes. So is 4 billion a lot? It is a lot. But as Mao Zedong said, if they kill 4 million, there's another half of the population left, and we have 1.5 billion. Absolutely true. So China survives. You just reorganize the world economy on a smaller level with obviously half of the world's population. Now with Trump, you have a different scenario, okay? It basically, Trump puts America's national interests first, focusing on improving the economy and getting rid of this huge debt. So how is Trump doing this? You know, on paper, again, it's very simple. If he raises the interest rates, which would be the easiest thing for him to do, John, you know, when he became president of the United States, there was no way that you can pay the interest on $4 quadrillion. So the system would have collapsed.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, you know, that would have meant that Trump would have needed to immediately present a new alternative economic model to Bretton Woods. But the thing is that Bretton Woods was a system put together by winners of World War II. And today we don't know who the winners are. And so there's no alternative system. And there is no alternative system. And you push the interest rates to 4 or 5% and the system collapses, the actual system. There's going to be nothing left of the world economy. And we are going to go to World War III. Except it's going to be thermonuclear. It's going to be the last war. So what Trump is doing, you know, aside from the fact that a lot of people out there think that he's crazy, he's insane, he's a misogynist, he's a, you know, but what actually what his economic policies makes a lot of sense, because there are alternative economic models. And one of these economic models being discussed since about 2001 is regionalization of clusterization of world economies, meaning dismantling of countries, destruction of nation states, meaning the end of Westphalia. Okay, so no nation states, no countries, no constitution, etc. And you know, this whole thing with California trying to secede from the Union and people trying to buy Baja California, it's the Mexican part of California, for $200 billion, it just gives you an idea what's coming. Because all the secessionist movements on the world stage, being in Catalonia, in Spain, in Scotland, in Ireland, and, you know, in other parts of the world, you know, in the Middle East and Central Asia, it's part and parcel of what we're talking about. Because, again, Bretton Woods is dead. There's simply no way you can make more money. Because, again, once they realized that the infinite growth ended and you cannot expand beyond the socialist bloc, which they already conquered, because before, they needed to conquer the socialist bloc because it was blocking 40% of the business. But once they conquered that, there was nowhere else to go. And that's one of the reasons they're building down. You know, that's one of the reasons Pentagon can't account for 44,000 employees. It's not like they disappeared. You know, they're down there building cities underground or up into space, space exploration, etc. But on the planet Earth, there's nowhere else to expand. And so what they're doing is dismantling the system and regionalizing the world economies. And this whole thing between America and China, this trade war, it's all nonsense. It's what governments do, intelligence agencies do, when they want to cover up their real intents. And what is actually being done right now, because again, I don't know if you know, but in 1979, Jimmy Carter and Deng Xiaoping, they signed a non-intervention agreement. It was a secret agreement for 20 years, and it was extended 20 more years and two more, basically till the year 2021, where neither America or China would invade the other. And they've held to this agreement for obvious reasons. And what you're seeing in this trade war, okay, this very violent trade war, is America, they have their own economic contour, which is dollar, and the Chinese have their own contour, which is based on a two-contour Asian system. On the one hand, you have gold and yuan, and on the other, you have electronic money to write off all these enormous quadrillion dollar debt. Because you can't write off the debt, you know, with physical gold, but you can't pull it through, you know, the electronic money, you know, to get rid of the bubbles. And that's what's being done on the world stage between the United States and China.
Wow. All right, now let me just shift gears here for a second. World War III, farther away or closer?
It depends, because again, it's a very difficult, it's a difficult question to answer there, because again, we're looking for a way out. There are three ways out of the crisis. One is global third war, thermonuclear war. Okay, it reduces the world's population by half, and then you just a question of rearranging that and making it work on a much smaller level. The other way out of the crisis is golden yuan and electronic money, which is what the Chinese are doing with the Rothschilds, because the Chinese and the Rothschilds work together. Okay, and the third way out is sixth technological development, which is NBIC, nanobioinfocognito, and cold fusion. And that's what the United States are doing now. And I can tell you, you know, I was with Putin a day before he talked to Trump in 2017. I met with him for 40 minutes, explained certain issues which he needed to keep in mind. At the time, it was fairly impossible to make some of these things known because it just wasn't the right time. However, they were brought up at the Helsinki meeting between Putin and Trump. Because basically, Trump offered Putin For if Putin decided, or Russia, because again, Russia is Putin, because Russia, historically, has been a nation or a country of a first person. In other words, you have a leader, be it a dictator, a czar, the president, and basically everything is run through him. Okay, so what Trump offered Putin is, in exchange for Putin looking the other way and giving up his friendship with Syria and Iran, the United States would acknowledge and recognize Crimea as part of Russia. They would give Ukraine back to Russia. And they would also push the oil prices to about $100 or $150 a barrel, because Russia would get obvious financial windfall from that. But we've discussed this again in January 2017, all of these possibilities, and none of them are good. Oil at $150 a barrel, and we're seeing it right now more and more. I mean, I've talked about this for a long time, and I explained it in my book. This is going to dismantle. Is it good for America? It's bad for America because it destroys the economy. But it destroys liberal banking financier sector. It destroys Trump's enemies. Trump shuts the door of the United States, and then he does with oil whatever he wants. It's the same thing that happened in the Soviet Union back in the 1970s with the oil crisis, with the, you know, Arab embargo in 1973. It didn't affect us that the oil went up 350%. We had our internal oil, and we sold it to ourselves. We had no need for anybody else's oil. And that's what Trump is planning to do, because, again, pushing the oil to $150 a barrel destroys the liberal financial world economy, controlled and run by Trump's enemies. While at the same time, you know, countries like Russia, Iran, etc., they have this $150 oil per barrel. The Americans, because they already have, or in the process of developing, cold fusion, and we've seen articles about this way back in March of this year, which means that they're going to six technological development and leaves the Russians in the dust, because we're still in the fourth. And so again, it's these are hard choices to make, but again, we've discussed this in January 2017, all these different issues. So again, war possibility. There are three ways out of the crisis. War is one of them. NBIC, nanobioinfo, cognitive technologies is another. And third, the Americans with the dollar on the one hand, that's the, you know, that's their side. And the Chinese go their way and do what they need to do, golden yuan and electronic money.
So the central banks, the central bank system, you're thinking it's not going to go on.
It simply can't, because again, the central bank system based on printing money,
yeah,
is dead. If you, again, one of the reasons why the interest rates are at a negative rate, again, $10 trillion of things are being traded at negative interest rates, is because there's nowhere to go. You remember back in 1979 and 1980, the interest rates were like at 19.5%, something like that. You know, but as you start, well, you know, because again, Reaganomics is about expansion of personal debt. That's the only way that they could survive. So as you print more money and people get further and further in debt, you needed to lower the interest rates because there's no way they could service that. But now we're at a point where no matter how much money you print, it has zero effect on the economy, okay? Because economy, although you can have an open system where you steal from others and use it, you know, to improve your bottom line, or in the financial sector where you're playing with numbers on a computer, in the real economy, the system is closed and money needs to move. And unfortunately, it's not going anywhere. And so it doesn't matter how much money. It's like, I'll give you a simple example which people can understand. If you're taking antibiotics, the first time you take it, it's very effective. The second time you take it in bigger dosage, it's still very effective. But when you've been at it for 35 years of taking antibiotics with greater and greater dosage, it's not going to have any effect on the patient, except it's going to kill it. And this is exactly what we're seeing right now. So where the point is, no matter how much money you print, you're not going to get any benefit out of the system. And I don't know if you know this, but America's salaries today, real salary, as at a 1958 level, when the collapse happens, the salaries are going to roll back to the 1920s of the 20th century, with a very small exception that the United States of 1920, the biggest city was New York, and its population base, I think, was about 2 million people. Now, how do you survive today in New York with 1920 salary in a city of 20 million people, or whatever it is that you have in New York City? You can't. So the point is, no matter what they do, they need to dismantle the system. And what Trump is doing is he is looking for regional allies on the world stage. And Putin just happens to be one regional ally he can work with, because, you know, if you kind of forget all this, you know, nonsense about Putin being this, you know, Ruski pickle-eating KGB Stalinist, it's nonsense. Putin is not a Stalinist. Putin is a right conservative like Donald Trump. They're both right-wing conservatives, and that's why both of them have common language and they like being with each other. I mean, Trump said one of the best experiences of his life was meeting Putin, and he's looking forward to their next meeting. But the media and the deep state and the liberal banking financier order can't allow them to meet, because, again, look how long it took for them to actually get together, because they understand, okay, that Putin and Trump working together will definitely put an end to the liberal banking financier order.
No. This fight between President Trump and the people who support him and this deep state, in your view, I'm thinking Trump's side is winning. What do you think?
Trump's side is definitely winning, which is why, again, you know, you're seeing in the fight which they just won for Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court, in all this other stuff going on politically, economically, and socially. The media tries to portray the fact that, you know, Trump is hated by most of Americans, and I think it's totally false. Again, I'm not pro-Trump or against Trump. I don't want people to think that, you know, I'm a Trumpy or Trumpster, whatever you call these people. I cannot be, because, first of all, I'm not American. Second of all, I'm Russian. So I look at Donald Trump, you know, from a point of view of someone who wants best for my country. Well, that means we analyze this character and see what can he do or can't do, or how can he hurt us. So Trump is definitely winning. And a lot of these incongruencies, which people don't seem to understand, like, for example, you know, if Trump and Putin are on the same team, then why is Trump putting all these sanctions on Putin? You know, it's very easy to explain, because, you see, the game is for keeps. The fight is not only who will control power, but who will live and who will die. So we basically left with one question. And the question is, how to seize control over emissions, meaning money printing, okay? Because the people that controlled it since 1944, and again, it's very important. I think there's a lot of confusion in people when they think that Trump represents the Republican Party and then Clinton Democratic Party. That's not true. Trump is not the face of a Republican Party. Republican and Democratic parties, they both part of the liberal banking financier world order. And that's why the Bushes publicly stated that they voted, you know, for Hillary Clinton, because, again, they don't represent Republican Party. They represent a model. And that model is based on Infinite Growth, Bret Woods, liberal banking financier order. And Trump is the enemy of these people. Because, again, the longer Trump remains president, the stronger these forces that stand behind him are, as well as their hold on power. You know, it doesn't really matter if Trump loses or not, because, again, he's not a person but a project. Trump and Putin working together will definitely destroy the world, a liberal banking order. And, again, you know, this whole thing about why is, you know, Trump putting sanctions on Putin, Trump needs to win midterm elections. And for him to win midterm elections, he needs to, you know, to be portrayed as, you know, rah, 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 American patriot, and not someone who is kowtowing to the Russians. Which is why, you know, if Congress puts sanctions on Putin, Trump is going to, you know, triple these sanctions, because he understands he needs to win the elections. But once that's over, you're going to see that these sanctions and a lot of other stuff is going to be rolled back.
Well, I'll tell you, that's interesting now. Space. We're going to expand our markets into space. You mentioned outer space a while ago. I'm thinking that might be a pretty good idea. Chinese are real keen on going to the dark side of the moon, getting a base up there and everything.
Well, you know, again, the thing is about space, and I talked about it in detail. I think, you know, I've discussed it a few years back when we talked about my book, Trans-Evolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, is you have two ways to go. You go, you know, expand on the planet Earth, or you expand into space. Okay, because you can no longer expand on the planet Earth, they're expanding into space. Now, expanding into space means controlling the outer orbit. Now, the lower orbit, you know, controls anything and everything that happens on the planet Earth. Satellite communications, intelligence, you know, your credit cards, everything. Okay, so you need that. That's one of the reasons why the Indians and the Chinese and the Russians, the Argentines and the Japanese and the Swiss and the Americans and everybody's going, even the, you know, the Venezuelans have three, you know, satellites up there. Everybody needs to be up in space, okay?
We get one.
The Americans have quite a few satellites up there, you know. So that's the first thing. Another thing you're gonna need, a new financial. You know, you need a clearinghouse. You need money, and so you're not gonna be playing with dollars. So you need electronic currency. You need some kind of alternative currency. And the third thing you need is you need the new telephones, you know, your cell phones, 5G as a new system. So once that's set up, because again, we're talking about lower space orbit, that's one thing. That's about 90% of business. And then you go into outer space, which is, you know, going to the moon, going to Mars, because, you know, Earth, moon, that's about a generation and a half project, which is, you know, basically deals with infrastructure problems. And that's one of the reasons why on planet Earth, you have the Americans and the Canadians and the British and the Russians, they're all fighting for control of the Arctic. Okay, and in fact, the Russians is the only country in the world that has about 1,000 kilometers from the North Pole, this self-serving station called UMKA, U-M-K-A. If the audience is interested, you can look it up online. It's fully equipped, fully functional system for 5,000 scientists who are basically training for eventually living on the moon, because the conditions in the Arctic are very similar to the conditions on the moon. So again, yes, everybody's going to space, because again, space is the final frontier. It's the natural resources. It's all, you know, you have helium-3 in space. So we're talking about energies. There's nothing cleaner, you know, better or longer lasting than helium-3, which is an isotope. And you have it on the surface of the moon. You can't have it. I mean, you have it in space, period. But moon is close, so you can get at it. And there's enough on the surface of the moon that you can literally pick up with your hands that will last for about 1,500 years on the planet Earth. And you talk about, you know, helium-3 to oil is what, you know, nuclear energy is, you know, to a guy in the Stone Age, you know, rubbing two rocks together to get his flame. So again, there's a lot of positives of going to space. There's a lot of positives with new technological developments, but all that stuff, needless to say, happens on the planet Earth, because the fight is for control of humanity. And we're literally seeing it in every nook and corner of the planet. The liberal banking financier order, which is going down, and the new order, yet to be determined, because again, we know that the Bretton Woods system was put together by the people who won the war. We don't have a new order yet, because again, we're not quite sure who's winning this one. But the point is, what you're seeing is not countries fighting each other, but global projects. That's another thing which nobody has ever talked about or understood. I explain it in my book. Because again, the United States, I think, John, you will agree, it's not a homogenous country, okay? It's not like America against Russia or the United States against China. If it's a homogenous country, please explain to me Clinton against Trump. Explain to me Antifa against the police, Black Lives Matter against whoever, National Rifle Association, all these crazies out there doing all this crazy stuff. I mean, you're in the midst of a civil war, so America is not a homogenous country. So what's at stake are not countries fighting each other. Because what we're seeing is the process of, again, if global 1.0, as Catherine Austin Fitz likes to call it, is this whole period between Westphalia, 1648, the creation of nation states, up until 1968, where at the Bilderberg meeting in Mont-Tremblant in Canada, the Bilderbergers, you know, as the representatives of these liberal financial circles, they agreed to put together this new concept called One World Company Limited, corporations with more power than any government on the planet. And that was put together in 1968. And that, you know, lived more or less on until the end of the 20th century and or 2008. And now we're into global 3.0, post-industrial world of networking. So when Trump, in his first speech, talked about infrastructure, He wasn't talking about bridges or roads or train tracks. He was talking about infrastructure of algorithms. Because the war today, one of the things about this trade war between China and the United States, it's between networks. You have Alibaba on the one hand and you have Amazon on the other. Europe is not playing this game because they don't have one. Okay, so they're completely out of the picture. It's a very interesting subtext on the stuff you never see on the mainstream news. First of all, because I don't think they even understand any of the stuff. Okay, it's about Trump, about his, you know, bedside, you know, habits, about who he slept with, what he did and how he did it, and what he wore, what he said. It's absolutely irrelevant. I mean, it's all bread and circus. Now they're talking about, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas, you know, her DNA testing. It's up, you know, it's utter nonsense. It's a different game being played on a supranational level. And again, it's not between governments. It's not chess. Zbigniew Brzezinski lied to us. Well, he lied to you. He didn't lie to us, but you was always nonsense. I mean, Brzezinski's and Kissinger's and McKinder's, when they're talking about the heartland and, you know, the great, great chessboard. And the elite don't play chess. Chess is white and black. And white always win because they have the initiative. They start and they win. The elite play a different game. The game is called bridge. It's a card game. And what we have actually done on the intelligence level is created a system that can explain, using bridge, the card game, how the elite groups work and fight each other. Because again, as I said, it's not the United States. Because Trump is not the United States. The United States today is liberal banking financier order. Trump represents a different project. Because again, if Hillary Clinton had the United States behind her, the bankings, the financiers, the Rockefellers, the Soros, you know, the mainstream media, Silicon Valley, Trump is taking it all down. The people who actually supported and financed Trump, these are the European aristocracy, British royal family, the city, not London, but city, the epicenter of the British Empire, Hong Kong and Singapore. These are the epicenter city states. These, because again, what is Trump? Trump is black international. Black international has nothing to do with the Nazis, has nothing to do with color black. Black refers to the soil, because again, black international is soil and blood. These are the old representatives of the elite circles, because Trump is half Scot, half German. This is what's behind Trump. And that's why when people say to me, oh, they're going to kill Donald Trump the same way they actually killed John F. Kennedy. Kennedy had no one behind them. Trump had the British royal family, he has the Rothschilds, he has all these power elite circles behind him. He's absolutely untouchable. The only thing they can do to him is impeach him. And they won't be able to do that because he'll win the Senate, because I think most of the seats for up for grabs are Democratic seats and other Republicans. And he'll probably clean up in the House as well. And if that happens, again, watch out. He goes on and he wins in 2020 big time.
Yep. All right. Now, wow. I got a note here. It says Russia, USA, duopoly. You know, historically, Russia's been portrayed as the enemy, always the enemy. I've always thought if there was a real enemy, and certainly I believe there is, it would be China. They want to dominate the world. But Russia has remained, even after our togetherness in World War II, and Joseph Stalin notwithstanding, they've always been the official enemy of the United States. If you say duopoly, does that mean that Russia and the United States are working together rather than against each other?
They have to, because again, up until, remember that Russia was America's best friend between 1991 and 1996. It was the period of the rape of Russia where they came in and basically stole everything from us. So we were their best friends, right? You come into my house and you steal everything from me. You steal my wife, steal my children, steal my things, you sell it, and you know, you leave me homeless, and so I'm your best buddy. But then Putin came in the year 2000, and things began changing a little bit at a time. Again, There's another thing important to understand if we're talking about Russia or the United States. Trump and Putin, they have the same problem. I mean, the two of them can agree because, again, they're alpha males. There's somebody, you know, in I can't remember what press conference, someone asked Putin, so what are you going to talk to Mr. Trump about? Do you have anything in common? He said, you know, Putin said, if we don't, we'll talk about women. So they will always have something to talk about. The point is that Trump and Putin have no team behind them. They're surrounded by traitors. I mean, Putin has been there for 18 years. But again, remember that president of Russia is one thing. The government is run by prime minister. And Prime Minister Medvedev, he's a liberal banking financier. And every financial position in the country is occupied by people beholden to International Monetary Fund. The same as in the United States until very recently. So for example, the general director of Russia Central Bank, her orders don't come from the government. Her orders come directly from the International Monetary Fund. So the entire edifice of Russia is controlled by the liberal banking financiers who've been there since 1991. And the United States, the same thing is going on as well. One of the reasons you're seeing all these leaks around Donald Trump is that, again, he's surrounded by traitors, be it an intelligence community, whether it's the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, or any one of the intelligence agencies, any one of the media, any one of the Hollywood, the Silicon Valley crowd, they're all against Trump and the conservatives. Why? Because, again, they're part of this global liberal banking financier order. So Russia and the United States must work together on the level of Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, okay? Because this is the only way that them working together can destroy, with the help of other nations as well, this global, because it is global, one unified liberal banking financier order.
All right. Cryptocurrencies, inscrutable, but coming our way, I mean, en masse, like digital currency, worldwide digital currency, no more currency trading. Is that even possible?
You know, again, if you're looking at all the Bitcoins and all these other coins out there, I mean, it's smoke and mirrors. There's nothing behind them. Do you know what I mean? It's not like you have physical gold that you can actually touch. It's all speculative for now. And one of the things that they're doing with cryptocurrencies right now is they're prototyping it. One of the reasons, well, now, not as much, it's not as obvious today as it was a few months ago when, you know, the thing would jump up and down. You know, people would be buying and selling, you know, on the margins. The thing is that by prototyping it, they need to make it scalable because it's not scalable right now. And one of the reasons it's decentralized today is that the governments, they need a lot of people working on a global stage for free, making this the cryptocurrency scalable. But once it is, they're going to centralize it. They can centralize it, you know, a million different ways and take it out of the hands of the people. Because again, ask yourself, why aren't there regional currencies in the United States and other countries? Because the government simply won't allow them. And why there are, I don't know how many thousands of cryptocurrencies, different cryptocurrencies out there, and why are they all out there? Because again, the government is interested in getting as many people as possible, making this thing as scalable and as marketable as possible. Blockchain is another thing, but the cryptocurrencies is something which is probably going to go the way of the dodo bird.
Wow, man, this is really something else. And so, all right. Daniel, why do you have to write about such complex subjects?
Because all the claptrap, you know, the Kardashians and stuff has been taken up by others.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll tell you, people are going to be RAM challenged. You know, I could use.
But, you know, I think what this book does, John, is, again, I started writing this book. The initial draft was, I think, early 2015. Because I had a pretty good idea that Trump would win. Because again, if we knew that Trump would be a good candidate, the people at a certain supranational level also knew. And when these certain individuals, like the Rothschilds, for example, and others, you know, come up to you and make you a proposition, you can't really say no. Okay, so what makes this book so different from everything else out there is, again, there's I don't dwell on personal details because I couldn't care less about Trump's, you know, affairs, you know, eating habits, you know, sleeping patterns, you know, his dress code, the things that it's absolutely irrelevant to me because, again, I look at Trump as a paleontologist would look at a dinosaur. And what I do in this work from a conceptual intelligence level, and that's much, much higher level up there, you know, than what spies do, as in looking for documents, stealing stuff, drugging someone, you know, to get them to, you know, some information on someone. I don't work that. I've never done that. I've always worked at a different level. You know, again, creating models that explain the future of humanity. And what I do in this book is that I explain things which are going to happen in the future. And my, you know, success rate is about 100%. You know, I've never been wrong because, again, we have a model in Russia and we use this to describe, define the future. And I think people who've, you know, been, you know, OD'd at all this Trump stuff, all these books out there on Donald Trump. And, you know, God willing, I sell as many copies as some of these other individuals do. But the point is that if you want a sober look at the Trump and all these characters around them from a position of someone who's predicted his, you know, ascension to presidency back in 2014, there's no other book out there in the market that will explain it better than my book.
All right, let me ask you about this. India. What about India and what about Africa? In your book, you describe that among some of the things that may be coming down the pike for us is a redistribution of financial machinery, breaking the world economy into regions. And I'm wondering where India and Africa, you know, China's trying to get their hooks into Africa all over. I mean, they're going for it big time. South Africa, Zimbabwe's gone. That's under Chinese control. Tanzania too, I reckon, and others. So, okay, we get that. They got plenty of muscle and they got plenty of money, at least it appears they do, and plenty of people willing to do business with them. But I'm just wondering, what about India? There's a lot of stuff going on over there. That's a lot of people in India. They're nuclear armed and all this. So I'm just wondering, where does India and maybe even Africa fit into things over the next, if you can even project this, over the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, I wouldn't even try it. I wouldn't even take a shot at what's going to be going on 10 years from now.
You made an interesting observation about, you know, the regionalization of the global economy, as I explained in one of the chapters in my book. As I said before, what we're seeing right now on a global stage is dismantling of countries. Call it nation states, call it Bretton Woods, you know, basically this dismantling of countries. Because the model is dead, and this model no longer produces wealth and will never produce wealth again. Will you print an unlimited amount of money, it will never give you any growth, which means they need to change a model. And one of the things they're actually looking at right now on a supranational level is regionalizing the world economies. Now, for a region, meaning a group of countries working together economically, that's what it means, okay? Only economically. A region would need a minimum population base of about 500 million people. So, for example, the regions that they're looking at right now, region one would be Canada, United States, part of Mexico, Australia, New Zealand. That's about 500 million people. You know, that'll be dollar denominated. Then the rest of Mexico and Latin America, that'll be, you know, peso, whatever you want to call it, denominated. That'll be region two. China would be a separate region. India would be a separate region. Russia would be divided into two by the Ural Mountains, you know, west and east. And Western Russia would include Russia, Turkey, Syria, probably Iran, the Turkic-speaking former Soviet republics, and maybe the Balkans. And the Western Russia, east of the Urals, is going to have the Koreas and probably Japan. Europe, you have the French-German axis, and that's going to include African French colonies in Africa. And so that basically leaves you with London, the British Empire, and the Middle East. Now, the plan initially was for London, for the British Empire, to join forces with the Middle Eastern countries and create a new currency, the golden dinar. But the only way you can get, you know, the Sunnis and the Shiites and all these, you know, crazies together is if you gave them a common enemy on the planet. And that common enemy was to be Israel. And Israel was going to disappear by the year 2020 or 2021. And I'm not saying this, and I want people calling me an anti-Semite. You know, the people who actually said this are well-known, such as Henry Kissinger and Jacob Rothschild. Well-known individuals. Back in 2012, in New York Post, Henry Kissinger said Israel is going to disappear by the year 2020-21. And that was one way of actually getting the Arab countries together. But that to do that, three things needed to be done. First, they needed to get rid of all the old northern African leaders, such as Bouteflika in Algeria, Mubarak in Egypt, etc. And that's what they did in 2011 with the Arab Spring. The second thing, if you're going to join the Arab countries with the British Empire, you had a problem with Iran and Turkey, which also had their dibs on some of these countries. So you had to isolate them. That was done as well. And the third part is getting Israel out of the equation. And the whole thing was prepared. The only thing that was missing was for Hillary Clinton to win the presidency. And then they would have been able to push that idea through. Again, these are the things that Henry Kissinger and Jacob Rothschild publicly stated. Okay, I don't work in conspiracy circles. I'm an intelligence officer. But then Hillary Clinton lost, John. And so the elite on a supranational level, they came up with Plan B. And that Plan B was Macron in France. Because Macron has worked for years for the Rothschilds. So he's an agent of the Rothschilds. And the Rothschilds forever has been the agents of the British Empire. So if you really look at it, the president of France is an agent of the British Empire. And the idea behind Macron, and I explain it in great detail in my book, was to split up the Berlin-Paris axis, push Berlin, which is national Germany, national socialism, into the hands of Russia and China, and open up Europe for England after Brexit. And you're seeing it done as we speak. Okay, and again, I explain it in great detail in my book. So these are some of the machinations that you're seeing on the global stage. Now, India is an interesting case because, again, these are no longer countries, but regions, and not even regions, but rather global projects. And some of these global projects, for example, is one is London. The other one is China. Another one is, you know, Great Europe. Then you have Red Caliphate, Sufi Tariqati, that's Turkey. You have the liberal project in the United States, and we're missing one. London, Europe, the United States, China, and we have China, Datun China. Okay, these are the six global projects. India would fit into this because, again, Russia today is a liberal banking financier order. But the idea for Russia and China to join forces, and today Russia and China, we are not friends. We are, you know, frenemies at best, friends and enemies. Because Russia is liberal, and liberalism is the enemy of humanity. And China is doing everything in their power, as is Vatican in Europe. And in the United States, we're seeing Trump, etc., trying to get rid of liberalism on the global stage. The only way Russia and China can work together is if Russia gets rid of liberalism. Now, India is very interesting because if Russia, not liberal Russia, but future not liberal Russia, can work together with Turkey, which is the Red Caliphate, then India would join forces with them. Because again, if you look at India, India is the Mughal Empire. Mughal Empire is Babur, the first emperor. Babur is Zahir ibn Muhammad. Okay, now the Indian Empire, through, you know, today's India, going back to the Mughals, today's India, would work with Russia and with the Red Caliphate Turkey in the future if Russia can get rid of the liberals. If they can't, then India will most likely work with London. Because again, Indians, you have 200 million Indians who are middle class, and India has most of their investments in London. In fact, they're the biggest investors in England and the world. So these are some of the breakdowns you're looking at the world stage, not as countries, but as regional economic groups or blocks.
Extraordinary. Well, how about those midterms? I think I don't think the big nasty blue wave is coming at all. I think the Republicans will hold the Congress. I just do, because the Democrats are so totally out of control. Even some of the Democrats recognize that this is going from juvenile to infantile in some cases. You know, everything from these ridiculous claims of Native American ancestry to impeach Trump. You know, impeach him for what? You know, that's the big
question. It doesn't matter. Again, it's irrelevant. The point is, that's why they're throwing Obama into the, you know, into the ring. That's why, you know, Al Gore is back at it. That's why the Clintons are at it. Justin Trudeau in Canada, you know, is putting 2 cents worth. You know, because again, it doesn't matter what you impeach him for. The point is, or they get rid of Trump, or they're minced meat, and they understand it. And yes, it's very funny. You know, the Pocahontas story. I mean, it is so ridiculous. I think, you know, if she ever had any intentions of running for presidency in 2020, I think today was the day when it was like, you know, the D-Day. And it's like, you know, she's not going to be president of the United States, because this thing is going to haunt her for the rest of her life.
What about... what about banks and drug money? I mean, let's see. I'm getting a vision in my head. Oh, yeah, it says HSBC. I'm sure they're not the only ones, but they're a big one. How does the dope money figure into all of this? Is that just another market that's huge? Is that why it's allowed to go on like this? I have a feeling that if anybody really wanted to stop the drug trade, they could do it pretty easily, actually.
They can't stop the drug trade for many reasons, but the key reason is drug money is the lubricant of the world's economy. You're looking at $950 billion a year in cash. I mean, you have 24 countries which are bankrupt on the world stage today. And all of these countries, whether it's Panama, whether it's Belize, whether it's, you know, it doesn't matter, Dominican Republic, you know, they're all using drug money to survive. If you take the drug money out of the equation, the world collapses onto itself faster than we can, you know, end this show in 10 minutes. So the point is, you know, again, this is another reason why Trump is the enemy of the liberal banking financier order. You mentioned Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation. You know, we're talking about Citibank. We're talking about, you know, remember old Wachovia Bank? I mean, they were caught, say, like 10 years ago laundering $364 billion of Mexican, you know, narco dollars. And the president comes out and says, I don't know what happened. And of course we believe him. Of course we believe him. You know, so the point is, the fact that Trump came out and immediately said, you know, I think it was like March 2017, that he wants to put an end to all this drug business. It goes against the grain, against anything that the liberal banking financiers could possibly wish. Because again, you know, of the few ways they have of making money, is laundering the, you know, the drug proceeds. And, you know, in the United Nations a couple of weeks ago, Trump, when they asked him about Colombia's new president, Duque, he said, you know, if Duque can reduce the drug money coming into America by a certain percentage, he'll be a great president. And if he doesn't, you know, he'll be remembered as, you know, another one of the bunch who, you know, was good for nothing and didn't do anything. And so, again, Trump is very serious, because, again, he understands that the drug money is a key element of the financial liberal banking circles, which are the banks, financial institutions, Wall Street, et cetera, et cetera. And because these are his enemies, he will do everything in his power to put a stop to it.
You know, Daniel, this is really quite interesting. In early in the book, Dr. Estulin has written a chapter entitled "The Insurrection," and there's some quoting of the Executive Intelligence Review, which is Lyndon LaRouche's outfit. And I'm just wondering, wow, this is amazing, because I only received your book, yesterday? And no, Saturday. And the British Empire still punching way above its own weight. How is this even possible? Now, you know, some of this writing well, first of all, what do you think I don't want to give the book away, but folks, believe me, there's so much in this book that it's impossible to give it away. And some of it is, most of it is most unexpected, but entirely feasible. It's over 200 pages. It's pushing up toward 250. And, 246, including the bibliography. So
that's because it's smaller print. You know, the Spanish version of this book with a bit bigger print was almost 400 pages. It's the same book.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't want people to think it's, you know, some light reading.
When you made those quotes about, and I just want you to do it your own way rather than me go reading chapters out of your book. But when you had those quotes in there from
Lyndon LaRouche,
a guy named Ingram, in Executive Intelligence Review. I mean, I used to run these people at the airport trying to hand out copies of the magazine. I took one every once in a while. I wound up getting a brawl with one of them over nothing. But maybe it was just...
They're feisty individuals. Lyndon, I mean, I can't remember what Congressman or Senator said many years ago, that the LaRouche crowd had the best private intelligence, you know, in the world outside of the official government. You know, they have excellent information. And I can tell you from, you know, being in the intelligence world, they have very, very good sources and very, you know, excellent information. Very seldom wrong.
I think you're right. The presentation was a little bit strange. And of course, we were subjected back in the 80s to all this vilification of Lyndon LaRouche and vilification of him. And
I wonder why.
Yeah, I guess we know now, don't we?
Yeah.
But what do you make of this thing about the British Empire being the one that is really...
It's the same thing. Where we're talking about, you know, the people battling Donald Trump. If you look at the media, if you look at the people who put together Wall Street at the very beginning, if you go back in history, if you look, you know, at all these think tanks, foundations, you know, NGOs, you know, people financed and controlled by the British, you know, you realize how much British influence there actually is. And also, if you look at all these banks, you know, Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, if you look at all these institutions out there, they're all financed and supported by the British. So again, they certainly have very strong influence over a lot of these different characters.
I got to tell you, I just have to ask, how long did it take you to put this together? I don't want you to give away writers.
No, the book, not too long, because again, once I sat down to write it, I wrote it in about 6 months. But because I had, you know, there's a lot of information, obviously, in this book, a lot of stuff, which people have never seen or can actually imagine exists, because you'll never see any of the stuff in the mainstream media. But the point is that because back in 2014, we pretty much knew that Trump would win. And because this regionalization of the world economies is something that we have been working on and off, at the intelligence and the economic level in Russia since about 2001, it wasn't really all that difficult once I had all the information to sit down and write it. Remember one thing, when we're talking about the economy, John, they asked the other day in an interview with Warren Buffett, you know, they said, well, how, you know, Mr. Buffett, you have for like, I don't know how many billions of dollars in cash, and, you know, can you explain to us what's happening? And he couldn't explain. He said, I can't explain what's going on in the world economy. He can't explain it. And there's a very simple reason for that. You see, the if you look at the last 11 Nobel Prize winning economists, for going back to 2008 crisis, all of them have won their Nobel for economics on some silly claptrap issues which have nothing to do with the theory of crisis. None of them in the West can explain the theory of crisis. We in Russia can explain what's going on. We have the language to explain what's going on. And what this book does, it helps people understand absolutely everything that's going on. Why? Because in the West, in the capitalist West, the language doesn't exist to explain the theory of crisis. And in Russia, we are the only place probably in the world that does have, not because the sky is bluer in Russia than it is anywhere else in the world, but because our economy was always based on the teachings of Karl Marx and Adam Smith. We always knew that there's no such thing as infinite growth. One of the reasons, Marx is not taught it in America is because the whole idea of limits to growth is an anathema to American capitalist system. You can't have limits to growth. You have to continuously expand. And that's how you define capitalism. But you can't expand anymore. We're seeing the effects of that. And the second reason why we have the language, and no one in the West does, is in the Soviet Union, we had a parallel alternative economic model, which again was very, very successful, okay, for a very, very long time. It's not the place to go into why the Soviet Union collapsed. It had more to do with the fact that there was no such thing as secession rights. If somebody died, a high-ranking official, he couldn't leave an inheritance to his children. And for many, many years, beginning in probably early 1960s, the Soviet nomenklatura, the people who ran the country, a lot of cases had a lot more power than American millionaires and billionaires. But when they died, because everything belonged to the state, their children had to start again and work their way up. And they wanted to be owners of the country. And the only way they can be owners and pass on the inheritance of things that's not theirs but the state's is by dismantling the Soviet Union, making it a capitalist country, joining forces with the West, and stealing everything that wasn't, bolted to the floor. Which is one of the reasons we have so many oligarchs and billionaires in Russia, because they stole everything. So the country, was very successful up until, and I know people are going to have a hard time believing this because, again, the brainwashing has worked very, very well, and it works very well because the media in the West is far better at it than anything anywhere in Russia or in the Eastern Hemisphere. But the point is that we have the language to explain the economy and a different economic model. One of the things that Putin offered Trump in their meeting in Helsinki is to create a think tank or an economic council and in Moscow and write a new economic model for the world, post-Bretton Woods, American and Russians working together on a new economic model. And Trump didn't say no. And you are not going to see any of this in any mainstream publications.
I got to tell you, man, this is really a fascinating piece of work. And folks, I'm not kidding you either. One sentence to you. This is how real wealth is created. The production process. Instead of borrowing money from the oligarchs, you create your own money as a sovereign nation and use it to escape from the clutches of the oligarchy. And this is what allowed the United States to resist the continuous attempts of the British Empire to recover the U.S. as an imperial protectorate. The difference between the monetary and credit systems is the principle on which the current oligarch system is based. And one more time, the current oligarch system is based on a Federal Reserve banking system.
And when we talk about oligarchs, these are not Russian oligarchs.
Right.
These are global oligarchs.
Right. I mean, a central bank system, not a Federal Reserve. Yep. Wow, this is insane. It really is. Hey, we can't, we've been talking for a while here, but I don't want to let you go yet.
Okay.
What do you make of Assange? I think I know, but I just want to hear you say it.
I wrote a book on Julian Assange called Deconstructing WikiLeaks. In my book, I explained, it was written in 2011, I think it was, or maybe, it was written in 2011. You know, when the whole hoopla was about Assange and WikiLeaks. You know, again, Assange's mom was part of a cult called Anne Hamilton Byrne. Okay, and that cult was a front for the CIA.
Oh, perfect.
I'm not saying, please, I don't want people saying, oh, so Estuin said Assange is here. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that this is a perfect decoy because, you know, you can't do these experiments on Americans in the United States. You know, so you export them to other countries.
Oh, gotcha.
And Anne Hamilton Byrne was a cult in Australia where young children, you know, were being brainwashed. And I explain the entire process in my book. I'm not saying at all that Julian Assange is a CIA agent. What I am saying is that the beginnings of WikiLeaks, as so many other things we have seen, you know, on the substrata political things, you know, had a very different intention than what the WikiLeaks became. Over time, Assange realized how he was being used. Okay, and that's what I exposed in my book. And Assange, you know, had a personal grudge against me. And he publicly stated it, especially it was a few months ago, related to something in Catalonia and their independence drive. Anyway, not here or there. It's irrelevant. The point is, I like Assange. I think what he's going through is terrible. And I think today's Assange is a very different Assange from 10 years ago. And that's important also to recognize.
I wonder where his fate lies.
I don't know, but I'm, you know, again, if you kind of analyze Trump's antics, because, you know, I gave you one example. He is saying, you know, I really like Putin, and then he's going out of his way to make sure that, you know, you get sanctions against Putin and putting him through a hard time. He's done this quite a few times. And what people have to understand is that Donald Trump is crazy. But the fact is that he is surrounded by enemies. And a lot of the same thing could be said about, you know, him bombing Syria. He needs to appease some of these circles to play one off against the other, to somehow push his agenda forward. It's not an easy task. You know, I can give you another example in Russia. I told you before that the entire edifice of Russia's economic council, every position of power on the economic level is controlled by International Monetary Fund. And up until 2017, the 16, the election of Donald Trump, Putin couldn't touch or fire any one of these crooks. And as soon as Donald Trump won the presidency, 2 weeks later, Putin fired the third most powerful economist in the country. His name was Ulyukayev, for stealing $2 million. Nothing. It was a bribe. $2 million. That's nothing. But the fact is, it was a trial balloon because had it been done, you know, during Obama's presidency, the West, the liberal banking financiers, would have interpreted that as a declaration of war against their interests in Russia because they take Russia to be their feud. And because, again, what had happened was in 1991, because, again, you have to understand that Putin, when he became president, he came in as the arbiter between three very distinct power groups in Russia. On the one hand, the Yeltsin and his family. On the other hand, you had the liberal banking financier oligarchs. And then you had the Siloviki, the intelligence community. And Putin was the arbiter between these three groups. And what basically had happened over time is that he slowly but surely gained position of power. But because the system itself was controlled from the West, Russia, the entire country, was controlled from the West, beginning with the dismantling of the Soviet Union in 1991, he couldn't dare fire anyone, no matter how powerful the West thought he was. And only when Trump won the presidency did Putin finally dare to try getting rid of one of the individuals, the third most powerful economist in the country, okay, Ulyukayev. And even that was the only thing he has done internally because, again, the entire country is run by the liberal financiers. doing everything in their power to dismantle and destroy Putin's presidency. The same thing you're seeing in the United States with Donald Trump. As the people in his party, the people in the intelligence community who are allegedly serving the interests of the United States are going out of their way to dismantle and destroy Donald Trump.
And lastly, do you think he's destroyable?
I don't think it really matters, John, because again, Donald Trump is not a person. He is a project of one part of this global elite representing America first, isolationists, industrialists, whatever you want to call them. If Donald Trump dies tomorrow in his sleep, somebody else will replace him because again, the people that lost power are the people, the reason they lost power in the first place is because they could no longer support, or the economic model no longer support that structure. There's no way that they can get back. There's absolutely no way. It's not possible. They're getting weaker by the day, and it's just a matter of time before Donald Trump destroys and, you know, gets the upper hand. He already does. He already has. But not fully, okay? I think we'll get a much better read after the midterm elections. But again, I think with the election of Kavanaugh and everything we saw over the last few weeks, as far as I'm concerned, it's a foregone conclusion.
All right. Golly. Have we, we could go on for a couple of 3 hours, you know that.
A couple of days, yes. Yes.
I'd like to.
Let's do it another day. It's almost midnight here.
I know, bro. I know it. I broed you, okay? At least I did bro you.
I'd love to be back on your show anytime you want.
Well, listen, I'll be ringing you. Let me ask you, what's the easiest way to get your books?
Probably the easiest way is Amazon. You go on Amazon and my books are there. You can do it through my publisher, Chris Milligan at Triday Press. A great man, a small publishing company out in Oregon. But publishes books that, you know, nobody else would touch anywhere in America. And, you know, just to give you an idea, my Trump book in Latin America is published by Penguin Random House. That's the second biggest publishing company in the world. They wouldn't touch my book in the United States with a 10-foot pole. They said, if we publish it, they will take us to court and destroy us. We can't. In America, in Latin America, we'd love to publish it. In Europe, my book is published by some of the biggest companies. In Spain, it's published by Planeta. That's the third biggest publisher in the world, who does about $2 billion worth of business a year. Okay, and publish 1,600 titles a year. Chris Milligan publishes about 8 to 10 titles a year. But something to be said. Or they can get it directly from me. I have books as well, which I can be more than happy to sign for the people. They can reach me or look me up at my Twitter account, at Estulin Daniel.
At Estulin Daniel.
Daniel. Or in the, you know, in the good old tradition of Pocahontas, smoke signals also work.
Okay. I got a carrier pigeon standing by at all times, just so you know. Now, let me ask you this. I got to let you go. Why would they not? What are they afraid of? Why would they not publish the books?
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much stuff against so many people on the left, right, and center. Do you know what I mean? It's not just a common front where you have this one enemy, the liberals, or the Trumpies. You know, it reveals things which they'd like to keep hidden. The establishment itself, be it the Trump people or the liberal banking financier, there's a lot of stuff in there they don't want Americans to see. I mean, they can watch Fox and they can watch CNN. They can watch this, you know, silly little debates between the left and the right and the screaming and the finger pointing. But when you get to the nitty gritty and you get above to the conceptual intelligence level and you read the stuff that I write in this book, people are going to say, wow. And they don't want that. They just think, is it really worth our trouble? It is in Latin America and it's doing very well in many different countries, but not in the United States. I think there's going to be serious pushback against them, you know, and this may affect their business in other sectors.
Understood. Understood. Well, it's a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
On this book, it's something else. I'm going to read it cover to cover.
Thank you.
Standard. You know, there used to be this thing called an Evelyn Woods speed reading course, and I took it. It wasn't hard, But this is one of these these books that you just want to just go slow.
This isn't a book that you read while you're watching TV, a baseball game, listening to the radio, playing with children, you know, reading stuff on your Twitter account and eating an apple at the same time. No.
Daniel, I promise this is my last question. I'm using the word promise, but I want to ask you something because you get around and you're up in Canada now and you've done all these jobs. You've got experience in Latin America. You've got experience in Eastern Europe, in Russia, and so forth. What is it psychologically that makes it so easy for us to be divided into basically two camps? You know what I mean.
Again, it's the old divide and conquer strategy. You know, I explained it in my book on Tavistock Institute. You get the, because again, it's sex, it's politics, it's power, it's money. You create artificial debate, you separate the two sides while you're selling guns and butter to two sides at the same time. It's done in America, it's done in Canada, whether you're talking about, you know, the illegal immigrants, the drug trafficking, you know, the pedophilia scandals. The apparatus works very well on both sides of the divide, and it's done the same way in every country in the world. Every country in the world, not only in the United States.
Understood and appreciated. Thank you very much for your time, sir. It's good to
see
you.
Thank you so much. Great to be on your show again.
We'll talk again soon, if not sooner.
Okay. Yes, sir. Anytime. Good night.
Daniel Estulin, everybody. Dr. Daniel Estulin. And I got to tell you something. This book of his will set you on the side of your head because there are so many things in it. Look, it's 246 pages, right? And he said it's because of the font, and it's true. But there is so much in this thing. I mean, he's not going to send me a check for telling you this, but I'm telling you, the paragraphs that I was able to just scan through a few pages, they take you places you don't expect you're going to go. If you look at just pick something like Ogos, for example, the national, it was like a national internet that the Russians wanted to put together back in 62. They worked on it for about 8 years, but they didn't get the funding. So it's one of many attempts to do this. Well, I don't know when the United States started working on its internet, but I will tell you this: things that go on in Russia and things that go on in the United States, when they're not paralleling each other, they just switch. Russia does a certain social policy for a while. The United States is doing their thing, and then they flip, which is why people wind up saying things like, gee, it seems to me like the United States has begun to look like the old Soviet Union, and Russia has begun to look like the way America used to look back in the day, back in the halcyon days of high productivity and national unity, and everybody's pretty happy. And we're still buying the rocket engines to launch our military satellites into space there to spy on them, presumably. So I suspect even more strongly now that we're a lot closer than most people would imagine. They are not the enemy, and they never have been. China, that's a different story. You take those people on, you better be prepared to go all the way because they are. And I hope Daniel Estulin will stay on the line for just a moment because I want to close the program here for this episode of Caravan to Midnight. And talk with him for a minute, and I'll be talking with you tomorrow night. Thank you very much for supporting the program. We couldn't do it without you. I say that frequently because it's true. And so I want you to know that I thank you very, very much. All your kindnesses, the books that you send, the photographs that you send, all sorts of stuff. A man sent me a set of photographs from the World War II days. And these photographs, you can see P-38 Lightnings being built at Lockheed Skunk Works. And those photographs would have been classified back in the day because they didn't want the enemy knowing that they were putting superchargers on those engines. Amazing stuff and amazing people. And I'm just, I'm just very deeply blessed, richly blessed to have an audience like you. And I mean it. Be seeing you. God bless.